Hello, this week on The Stack, we speak with CNN's chief international correspondent Clarissa Ward on her new memoir, On All Fronts, The Education of a Journalist. Plus, Monocle's deputy editor Josh Fannett previews our new book, The Monocle Book of Gentle Living, and our brand new October issue. And we also speak to Swiss-Italian publisher Carlo De Benedetti on his new paper, to be released this week, Domani. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, Monocle's Josh Fannett gives us a preview of Monocle's recent titles. Plus, Carlo De Benedetti tells us all about his new paper to be released this coming week. But first on the show, I had the pleasure to speak with Clarissa Ward, CNN's chief international correspondent. In her new memoir, On All Fronts, The Education of a Journalist, Clarissa tells us the behind-the-scenes from her various assignments in Syria, Egypt, Afghanistan. She also discusses being a journalist in this age of extremism. Here is Clarissa with more.
Up until, while I was in university, I was studying comparative literature and watching French New Wave cinema, and I thought I wanted to be an actress. I was passionate always about storytelling and traveling and languages. But it was only when 9/11 happened, and I think a lot of people across the world felt this way, but everything changed. And I had an epiphany moment where I realized that I hadn't been engaged enough with what was going on in the world. And I needed to better understand how this had happened. And I wanted to sort of try to act as a communicator, to try to understand what had happened, to communicate it to people back in the US and in the West, and in the process to try to stop this kind of miscommunication and dehumanization that I felt was responsible for this heinous act of violence. Keep in mind, I was 21, right? So I was full of ideals and more than a little hubris.
Well, and it's so funny, you're 21. I mean, to be honest, you're still quite young, but the world have changed so much during this, let's say, 20 years. You know, people are saying we're living this new age of extremism. As a journalist, do you feel that the job of a journalist is becoming harder in a way?
The job of a journalist has definitely become harder because we never used to be the target. We would be the people on the sidelines telling the story. Now we're considered fair game. And whether that's, terrorist groups like ISIS executing journalists, beheading them, or whether that's authoritarian regimes disparaging and undermining us, or frankly, even the president of the United States calling us fake news. I mean, these all conspire together to make it a very tricky and often dangerous path for journalists to navigate. Social media has really opened the floodgates to anyone can set themselves up on Twitter. And if they've got 10,000 followers, even if they never leave their basement, they can describe themselves as a journalist. They can create narratives that coincide with their political convictions, and they can bandy about these terms like fake news, which, shouldn't really matter very much, but they do, because it's just this insidious undermining both of journalism, but more importantly, of the idea of facts and truth.
Well, and thankfully, Clarissa, I mean, the beginning of your book, it's quite powerful, actually. A very sad scene in Syria, when there's a young man in a coffin. But then it was interesting that you wrote there that some people wanted you to capture that moment, to show to the world. So in that sense, I think there's a lot of people actually your job is quite significant for many people as well.
Yeah, and you can't help but feel in Syria, well, I've really struggled with feeling that I let people down because they risked their lives to show me and to show other journalists the incredible risks they were taking, the sacrifices they were making, and the extraordinary brutal tactics they were victims of. And we told their stories and the world knew about their stories, and still the international community was not really able to come together in a coherent way to do anything to mitigate their suffering. And I think that's one of the hardest parts of being a journalist, is trying to reconcile what you're doing and why you're doing it, with the very real limitations of what you can actually do to help people. Because in Syria, as you mentioned, people were desperate to get their story out, and they really truly believed that if the world understood how they were being bombed and shot at and kidnapped and tortured and disappeared, that something would change, that something would happen to put an end to their suffering. And it didn't.
And Clarissa, and maybe on a personal level, is fear a constant on the job, perhaps, that, you know, as an international war correspondent as well? Or you didn't even think about that when you were there covering such events?
I am naturally a fearful person, which may sound odd to some of your listeners, because I think there's this idea of the war correspondent as a sort of swashbuckling adrenaline junkie. I'm not like that at all. I get incredibly frightened in situations where risks are high, or certainly if there's any kind of shelling or bombing or bullets whizzing past me. So yes, fear is a constant. And I try to put myself in situations where I'm not going to be directly in harm's way. But my passion or my commitment really is to tell the stories of the civilians who are most often the victims of these conflicts. And usually that entails getting much closer to danger than ideally one would like, but it sort of comes with the territory.
It's interesting, Clarissa, you've been through, I think you started, you know, Fox News, ABC News, CBS, and now at CNN. You've been through quite a lot of networks in a way, so I'm sure they all work in some ways differently. I mean, did you notice that? Of course, Fox News, I mean, you've mentioned as well. I mean, even being, you know, kind of a woman covering such events, that you have, you know, people care about appearance more than if it was a man. I believe you've experienced it all, right?
I don't think there's a single woman who works in television who has not experienced the pervasive misogyny that exists in this industry. And in some ways, you're sort of taught to think it's normal, because, yeah, it really does matter what you look like on television. It doesn't mean you have to be beautiful per se, but, you know, you can't look well, you're encouraged to keep your weight down, to have your hair look pretty. At Fox News, they wanted me to wear my hair down. Women were encouraged to wear dresses, things of this nature. And I have to ask you, I mean, how many women do you see above the age of 50 on television news? Yes, there are some, but there should be a lot more when you think of how many men above the age of 50 are on television, who are still doing that kind of TV reporting for work. So I am concerned that there's a double standard. I think it's getting better, but I think we have a long way to go.
Well, and let's talk about some of the amazing work you've done. And I think Syria is one of them. I mean, you've covered the country so well, and I'm sure you've been through quite difficult periods there. So tell us a bit, when was the first time you went to Syria as a correspondent?
Well, I was going back and forth to Syria when I was living in Beirut as a young reporter at the age of 25. That was mostly just to study Arabic, though, and to have a different experience. But I started covering the Syrian conflict in October of 2011. So it was quite early on. And every journalist, I think, has that one story, that one war that just grabs a hold of your heart and doesn't let go. And for me, that was Syria. And I knew immediately that it was going to be a sort of long and very intense and often very painful relationship that I had to this country and these people and to this incredible and incredibly saddening story. And so I just kept going back, even when it was becoming untenably dangerous, even when it was becoming clear that, you know, almost every trip I did, someone I knew or had spent time with was killed or kidnapped or disappeared. And that does take a toll on you as a journalist. But at the same time, the more you cover a story like that, the deeper your reporting becomes and the better the quality of the work is. So it can be hard to take a step back when you know that you need that intimacy and you need that passion to do your best work.
When you started your I mean, new job title at CNN, Chief International Correspondent, what really changed? I know you're based in London, but do you know? So, for example, I know you covered the Paris attacks in 2015. So it's quite varied. I mean, I think your agenda, you never know where you're going next, in a way.
You never know. Every time you go to bed, you know that there could be a call at 3 a.m. saying, get on a plane to Iraq or get on a plane to Nice or wherever it might be. The whole point of my role at CNN is that, having done this for a while now, I am able to hopefully cover a really wide range of stories, because news changes all the time, and terrorism may be a huge story for a couple of years, but then quickly populism takes over and becomes a huge story. One war ends, another begins, famines break out, and you have to have the sort of agility and flexibility to be able to dart from one story to the next and to shift gears really pretty quickly. And I'd say that's one of the most challenging aspects of the job.
And this year must have been quite challenging as well with coronavirus, because even when you have to report such a, you know, like a war story in Syria or something else, I mean, there's a whole other challenges involved as well now, right?
Yeah, how do you cover a war against an invisible enemy from your living room? And I use the word war, and like, obviously it's not a violent conflict, but nonetheless, you're seeing the world galvanized by this pandemic, hundreds of thousands of people's lives being claimed, economies being destroyed. And so I don't think it's hyperbole to call it a war, but we're so limited in how we can tell this story as journalists. And even when you are able to get into hospitals, for example, or travel to other countries where the outbreak has been particularly fierce, you're also limited in terms of trying to humanize this story by the fact that people are wearing masks, they're wearing PPE, protective equipment. And so for me, one of the biggest challenges is, how do you convey the heartbreak of this story? How do you convey the loss of this story? And that is very, very difficult.
Clarissa, I want to see a film called On All Fronts. Have you ever thought about it? I mean, it doesn't need to be a film. It can be a lovely TV series as well.
I mean, you know, of course, I've thought about it in the sense of, I do think it would lend itself well, particularly to a sort of series in the vein of Netflix or whatever, because there's so many different places and so many stories and so many rich lessons about the world and so many exciting adventures. And I think there's heartbreak, and I think there's moments of humor as well, if I'm allowed to sort of shamelessly tout my own book like that. But listen, I wrote this as a love letter to journalism. I wrote it so that my sons would have a sense when they're older of some of the things I've experienced and what I've learned along the way. And I wrote it really also so that people would see the stories behind the stories, because so often as journalists, these small human interactions and acts of kindness and highs and lows and tears and laughter, they don't make it onto the evening news, but that's what shapes the way we see a conflict. That's the way we learn about people and the world. And so it was so wonderful for me to have an outlet to finally share those things.
I completely agree with what you said, because you do humanize stories, because I think sometimes people, when they don't know, let's say, you know, when you talk about Syria, it's almost like if it's another planet, you know, it's like it's such an other that people sometimes don't realize.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And it's one of my biggest concerns and frustrations is that often we tend to use language that can be alienating, geopolitical jargon. Well, a lot of people don't have the time or the bandwidth to be following the minutiae of these very complex conflicts day by day. And that's another big part of why I wanted to write the book. You don't need to know anything about Syria to read this book, to feel connected to this story, and to hopefully have a really profound sense of what an incredible, beautiful people the Syrian people are and how much they've suffered. And that to me is so vitally important. I want people who aren't reading the world news section of the newspaper every day to be able to read this, to be able to connect and to feel genuine compassion and curiosity about people around the world.
That was Clarissa Ward there. Her memoir On All Fronts is out now, published by Penguin Press. And exciting news in Italy. On the 15th of September, the country will have a brand new newspaper, Domani. Published by Swiss-Italian Carlo De Benedetti, the paper will be a welcome addition to the country's edicolas. Our editor-in-chief, Charlie Brulé, spoke to De Benedetti about the new media venture on our show, The Chiefs. Here is a highlight of that conversation and what we can expect from the paper.
I want to maybe start with you maybe pulling out your graphic design and editorial tools for us. It's difficult to do, of course, on radio, but you're going to have to do it. What type of newspaper will greet people over the coming weeks? Of course, there must be a lot of work being done already on front pages, etc. What are we to think of? Are we to think of something completely new? Are we to think of something which maybe has the sober feeling of the Frankfurter Allgemeine, or maybe picking up the Neue Zürcher Zeitung? Does it feel a little bit Il Foglio? What's in your mind? And what can you conjure up for our listeners when we think about seeing this front cover for the first time at the Edicola?
First of all, you mentioned Il Foglio, which is a nice publication, but is directed to a very selected group of people. So we are not in that game. We want to be a newspaper which has to be read if you want to be objectively informed on politics, economy, having a strong group of investigative journalists, and a newspaper which takes into great account the green economy. So we are far away from the Foglio idea, which again is directed to an elite. And on the contrary, we are not looking for an elite. Second, we are a digital initiative. That means that our starting point and our success is going to depend from subscriber of our digital edition. I decided that just a site without having a paper edition would have been difficult to emerge as a leading origin of information, because the mentality is still that the paper is still very important, the paper edition. So we are just starting on an opposite way as traditional newspaper has done. Traditional newspaper, for reasons which are linked to their heritage, started all with a printing edition and then added to their printing edition a digital version or a website. We are proceeding exactly in the opposite way. Our success is going to depend on how many digital subscribers we are going to have, not how many paper copies we are going to sell. Our model, from that point of view, is completely new. There is no other publication that I know which has started digitally with a paper presence instead of the opposite.
Many would ask the question, and it goes back to your starting point, that you're launching as a digital first product with a print component. Why bother with the print? Wouldn't there be lots of people, you know, sitting around a traditional management meeting saying, listen, Mr. De Benedetti, why are we bothering to cut down trees? Why are we bothering to have a press going? What does this do for us as a brand? Why do we need paper? Now, personally, I know the answer and I think it's great, but I'm wondering, how do you defend this to people when they say, well, look, just fine, be on an iPhone, be on someone's Samsung, be on someone's laptop. Why are we printing to begin with?
Because there is probably a prejudice by which publication has to be a newspaper in the traditional sense of the word. And newspaper means news and paper. This is still a concept which is very strong among the public. And this is the reason why I think that we want to be a paper as well, like the word of newspaper is indicating.
That was Carlo De Benedetti speaking to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. The first issue of Domani is coming out on the 15th of September. Our show, The Chiefs, where Tyler speaks to different chief executives around the world, premieres every Tuesday at 1 p.m. London time, and you can hear more episodes on our website. Monaco is also hosting from Wednesday, the 16th of September, the Chiefs Conference 2020 in St. Moritz, a new summit that brings together some of the sharpest minds in business. You can find out more about the event on monaco.com. And finally on the show, it's an exciting week ahead for Monaco. We have a new book out, the Monaco Book of Gentle Living, a guide to slowing down, enjoying more, and being happy. And we also have a new issue out, our October issue, with a focus on how to design a better world. And who better to preview those titles than our deputy editor, Josh Fennett.
We've done many books before and we've always focused on things that were part of the real wheelhouse of what Monaco was interested in. So that might be building a better home for yourself, the kind of place where you really feel like you can relax, where you can shut the door and be away from the world. You know, we've talked about what a good life is and about quality of life. But the funny thing is that this book does feel rather relevant to now, you know, in a period where people have thought long and hard about the importance and value of their health, of their community. We've actually been touching on these topics for a very long time, so the idea of doing an entire book about gentle living was very much an idea that started before the pandemic. We did in February an expo, a kind of photo-led feature in the regular issue of, I believe, the Feb issue of the magazine. And it gave you these little bits of wisdom, you know, how can you get a better night's sleep? How can you, I don't know, take a bit of time for yourself? And the broader context was something I think your listeners and perhaps you and me think about quite a lot, which is that we're at a bit of a divided moment in history. We're at a bit of a finger waggy, shouty, bitter recriminations moment where people are very quick to blame each other, to turn to Twitter, to say that things have never been worse. And I think we all have that within us. I wouldn't blame anyone that thinks like that. This book is just a gentle invocation to, I suppose, be a bit nicer to ourselves. Nothing wrong with that. Be a bit nicer to each other. I think nothing wrong with that either. And probably to be a bit nicer to the planet and our surroundings as well. So you get these ideas, you know, they're not all entirely our ideas, only us talking about them. But to buy things once and well, it's a very fundamental Monaco idea. You might look at the magazine and say, God, that's an expensive stool made in Finland, or maybe I'll never live in that kind of amazing residence in LA. But to be honest, you know, as the editor of a book, I don't own that stool and I don't own that residence, but I can see the value in appreciating these things and aspiring to them and maybe making some kind of small changes to our life that just are a little bit gentler to us, whether that's not answering emails in bed, leaving the phone outside the door, making a personal decision about privacy. You know, all of these things seem like big topics and big discussions, but they're actually things with quite gentle interventions that we can do every day to improve our plight. So that was the premise.
Well, talking about gentle interventions, one part of the book talk about balconies. And it's quite interesting because I've been quite invested in my own balcony in recent months, you know, like how to make it pretty. And again, a very little thing. You could just leave it there, you know, kind of lifeless. But then if you kind of invest, it's so interesting how it becomes so important to you.
Well, it's funny you should mention balconies because gardening is a bit of a thing in the book. And we do in our Sunday newsletter do a little gardening tip, which I generally write called potluck. And, you know, I found myself thinking, well, you know, a lot of people don't have gardens. And should I not be doing it because that's, you know, an annoying thing to do? But gardening is, I think, quite central to the book because it's fundamentally hopeful. You plant something, you hope it will grow, you take care of it, you nurture it. And we're not saying that you need to have some huge palatial garden in the back of your house. You can grow something on your windowsill and it can be meaningful. And I think the poignancy that's been added during lockdown is that a lot of people have done that for the first time. A lot of people have thought to themselves, you know, what can I do with this discarded avocado pip? I'll look up on the internet how to grow it into something. You know, I grew some sunflowers for the first time this year, you know, and I'm no Alan Titchmarsh. I'm not sure that reference makes it to Brazil, but you know, the act of doing something is at once extremely simple, but it's also quite philosophical. I think it's I'm going to quote Voltaire actually for once, but at the end of Candide, the bit of advice is we must cultivate our garden, and that doesn't literally mean our garden. It means the things around us, and by cultivate it means care for, nurture, look after. So the book isn't highfalutin at all, despite the fact I'm coming across as a very pretentious person. It's about these little, subtle, small things. I've just got a page open here and it says, learn to play an instrument. Now, we're not going to come round your house and check you got to grade 8 in 6 months. It's about, you know, just doing something with your hands, disengaging from a phone, from a laptop, from the task of constantly answering your emails. You know, we wrote something about swimming in there as well. You know, swimming's quite a political activity in a way. It's not something you can do in your bedroom, unless your house is flooded. It's something you have to do with other people, where you strip off, you take away the armour that surrounds you and the things that you wear to protect yourself, and you go into a space which is usually a shared space. If you do it in a city like Copenhagen, it's because the city cared enough to clean up the water around you. And what we're doing is just kind of trying to bring people back to that sense of wonder that's quite central to Monocle in every issue of the magazine. We're looking for positive case studies. We're looking for people that make interventions that make our cities better. And as you said before I began to ramble, this can be as simple as planting out your balcony. It looks nice from the inside. It's rewarding. It looks nice from the outside. And it kind of gives this hopeful edge to a city. If no one looked after their balcony, our entire city would look different. And therein lies, I think, a metaphor.
And finally, Josh, we have the new issue out as well this coming week, which again talks about similar kind of topics that the book touches, how to design a better world. I think that's the main theme of this issue, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, this is a print industry show, so it'll be no surprise to listeners that, you know, the magazine world has been affected broadly negatively by the pandemic. But one interesting thing, you know, for every lost sale of an issue because people aren't in airports, where a lot of people buy Monocle and other magazines, of course, you know, for every lost shuttered newsstand, we've noticed a real engagement from our readers. We've never had so many letters, we've never had so many emails, we've never had so many people writing in who don't have a point of view, who are just saying thank you or we appreciate that. And I think the How to Design a Better World takes up the mantle of what we've been doing for the past few issues, which is trying to give people something hopeful to look forward to, something tangible to have faith in, because there are so many reasons not to be hopeful at the moment. And I think the idea of designing a better world, also, you know, you don't have to be sitting behind a mahogany desk in New York with, you know, billions of pounds in the bank. You can be at home and it can be about planting a tree outside your house. That can be your simple urban intervention. It can be putting a bench outside your shop where people can sit. It can be about thinking carefully about the way that you get to work. You know, is it a sustainable, safe, interesting way? You know, anyone that were to level an accusation of elitism against Monocle, I'd say that the ultimate luxury for our readers is probably the ability to cycle to work. There is just something embodied and personal about it that is interesting. And all of the people that we feature in the magazine, you know, they do talk about serious issues. There's a section on how to fix the US, protecting Estonia. We have a section about retail and the shops that manage to keep on selling. We, you know, we've done other things, you know, in a climate that's unfortunately warming. We look at desert architecture and what we can learn from it, how perhaps using a natural breeze rather than a heavy air conditioning unit could be just a small, subtle intervention that you make in your house that contributes in some small way to a better world.
That was Josh Fennett there, and you can pre-order the Monocle Book of Gentle Living on our website, and our new issue will be out this week. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hull. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monocle.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And before we go, a little song for you. And as we're talking about gentle living, here is one of the gentlest songs on my playlist. Bebel Gilberto with So Nice, Summer Samba. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. Summer to hold.